WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
Paul O'Neill was fired from his job as George Bush's Treasury Secretary for disagreeing too many times with the president's policy on tax cuts. Tonight, O'Neill, who is known for speaking his mind, talks for the first time about his 2 years inside the Bush administration. His story is the centerpiece of a new book being published this week about the way the Bush White House is run. Entitled The Price of Loyalty, the book, by a former Wall Street Journal reporter, draws on interviews with high-level officials who gave the author their personal accounts of meetings with the president, their notes and documents. O'Neill, who was George Bush's top economic policy official, says in the book that the president did not make decisions in a methodical way. There was no free flow of ideas or open debate. At cabinet meetings, he says the president was like a blind man in a room full of deaf people. There is no discernible connection, forcing top officials to act on little more than hunches about what the president might think. This is what O'Neill says happened at his first hour-long one-on-one meeting with Mr. Bush.
I went in with a long list of things to talk about, and I thought to engage on. And as the book says, I was surprised that it turned out me talking and the president just listening.
He never asked a single question.
As I recall, it was mostly a monologue.
And what happened at President Bush's very first National Security Council meeting is one of O'Neill's most startling revelations.
In the very beginning, there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and that he needed to go.
He says that going after Saddam Hussein was topic A 10 days after the inauguration, 8 months before September 11th.
From the very first instance, it was about Iraq. It was about what we can do to change this regime.
Everybody else thought that grew out of 9/11.
No.
But this book says it was day one of this administration.
Day one, these things were laid and sealed.
As Treasury Secretary, O'Neill was a permanent member of the National Security Council. He says in the book he was surprised at the meeting that questions such as why Saddam and why now were never asked. It's all about finding a way to do it. That was the tone of it. The president saying, go find me a way to do this.
For me, the notion of a preemption, that the U.S. has the unilateral right to do whatever we decide to do, is a really huge leap.
You're giving me the impression that you're just going to be stunned if they attack you for this book. And they're going to say, I predict, you know, it's sour grapes. He's getting back because he was fired.
I will be really disappointed if they react that way, because I think they'll be hard put.
But are you prepared for it?
Well, I don't think I need to be, because I can't imagine that I'm going to be attacked for telling the truth. Why would I be attacked for telling the truth?
That was a clip from a 60 Minutes interview done by correspondent Leslie Stahl. We just heard Stahl saying that everybody thought that the Iraq invasion was a response to 9/11. Who is everybody? Certainly, regular listeners to this program have had access to a range of information that would lead to a very different conclusion. And how can it be that O'Neill, after relating his experiences, which included being fired for criticisms of the White House economic policy that turned out to be accurate, could imagine that his public truth-telling would draw anything but the most vicious attack from the Bush political machine? And for that matter, why would millions who work for wages continue to support both a political party and a political system that has demonstrated repeatedly that it acts in the interests of the rich and the devil take the hindmost? Our first speaker tonight, soldier-turned-social critic Stan Goff, will address the need to attack what he calls the ideological cattle chute that renders even the obvious invisible. And in our second hour, how that cattle chute is maintained as we continue with readings from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. This week, The Primacy of Attitude, How Conformity to the Dominant Social Order is the Hidden Qualifying Criterion for Would-Be Professionals. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good, and I'm friendly to strangers. I ride and you're running, makes my guns talk the best. But the rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me. I'm incredibly pleased to be able to bring you the talk that you're about to hear by Stan Goff. Goff is known for his surgical but passionate dissections of the motives behind the rhetoric of American militarism. His view is very much informed by his life experience. He began a military career at the age of 18 as a paratrooper in Vietnam. Over the next several decades, he participated in U.S. military campaigns in Latin America and Africa as part of various elite corps, including the Rangers and Delta Force, and lastly served during the U.S. invasion of Haiti in 1994 as Master Sergeant of a Special Forces A-Team. Since leaving the military, he's devoted himself to understanding the social system that underlies U.S. militarism. He's authored numerous articles as well as a book about his experiences in Haiti, Hideous Dream, published in 2001 by Soft Skull Press. Goff spoke on January 14th at the One Dance People's Summit in Santa Cruz, California. MC Mickey Z introduces the speaker.
Henry Kissinger once said, "Military men are dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy." Howard Zinn once said, "No human being should be written off, no change in thinking deemed impossible." So before we write off soldiers as mindless pawns or brainwashed murderers, I suggest that you listen carefully to what our next speaker has to say. Please welcome Stan Goff.
All right, it's 12:40 at my house right now, so if I'm capable of stringing together a coherent thought, it's very close to being miraculous. And I got the program here, and someone's put in big capital letters, that "Do not miss this speech," which is like, oh, no pressure there. Whew. I was in the Army for a long time, so I'm going to be talking to you tonight a little bit about the stuff that you've been hearing, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the military as an institution, but I want to stop and for a moment and thank the organizers of the One Dance Summit for the commitment and their hard work and for the opportunity to come together with people I've admired for some time. It's an opportunity to spend some time with many of the thoughtful, serious Californians we never hear about on the East Coast to when the press goes breathless about the latest entertainer to become your governor. I actually spent some time with your governor a couple of years back. I was desperately unemployed when I was offered the opportunity to work as a technical advisor for Warner Brothers in Mexico during the filming of Collateral Damage, a movie that was delayed for some months in its release when the Twin Towers went down in Manhattan. And it was a movie, like a lot of movies, that went to a great deal of trouble to get the appearance of authenticity in every scene, even as it worked hard at a completely distorted representation of international relations and warfare in its narrative. And it worked hard to confirm the superiority of white Americans as well as the prerogatives of patriarchy. And it never set out to do any of these things. It was just a movie. It was following a formula. And it didn't want to distract anyone from the action with a critical or a rebellious thought. It was part of a larger system, and it's a much larger system. It's a worldwide system now that needs these kinds of symbolic stabilizers, these violent, mythopoetic fables that reinforce the existing relations of power and anesthetize us with vicarious cathartic experience at the same time. And let me say at this juncture that I'm not a credentialed academic, even though I've been hitting the books like one now for about 8 years. I'm an old soldier who's cut through the fence around the academy because I knew they had something valuable in there. Anytime rich people, especially rich white men, have something that they try to control for themselves, it's a pretty good indicator that it's something valuable. And in this case, it's something valuable they need to exercise power. Knowledge is valuable, even limited ways of knowing. Language is valuable, even if it's limited to its linearity. Ideas are valuable, even if they're distorted by ignorance or reification or self-interest. These are the tools for both interpretation and mastery, and anyone who is involved seriously in political work is by definition involved in questions of power. Power is both and at the same time the power to interpret and the power to master. In Iraq right now, there's an anti-occupation struggle going on, an armed struggle and an unarmed struggle, but in a sense, all actors seek to be armed, either literally or figuratively, by information with which to interpret the motives and actions of a foe, armed with the skill to use the various technologies of war, but also armed with the power to interpret for others and to mobilize the people to one side of the struggle or another. So there's a material dimension to war, and there's a symbolic dimension to war. Neither of these dimensions presents itself honestly to us because someone else gets to interpret it. And a lot of that goes on inside the academy and inside the entertainment media that poses as the information media. This construction of the ways of knowing, this putting on of limits of what is respectable, this reduction of the definition of knowledge within the narrow boundaries of empirical data, these serve like walls on a cattle chute to direct us into an ideological corral. If we're going to change the world materially, and in the short term we are going to have to confront this war, then we have no choice but to change the world socially and symbolically, which means we have to recognize that those walls are there and break out of the ways of knowing that have been constructed for us, not by those individual people who rule, but by the very process within which they themselves are both dominant and trapped. They are dominant within this process, but they are trapped within it too. That's why I say this is a necessary war, not a moral war, but from the standpoint of the U.S. ruling class, this war is necessary. The system requires war. The process by which the entire world now works requires war. So to escape war, we first have to figure out how to escape the logic of this system, this ordering process of 21st century globally networked industrial capitalism under the direction of the government of the United States of America. If we're going to figure out the question of how to confront the current war, we have to figure out what this process is and what it is doing. And if we are going to do that, then we have to look behind the facade that the system constructs for itself. War has a huge moral dimension. Many of us would not be engaged in opposing these kinds of military adventures were we not desperately and passionately committed to the project of building community, restoring the human family, and collaborating to amplify the wonder of life and to attenuate its suffering. But the reality is that the moral dimension of this war exposes almost nothing about its underlying causes. And in many cases, the moral dimension of war actually obscures those underlying causes. Moral categories are not adequate to understand what we are witnessing, so we need new categories, which in no way suggest we should abandon our moral objections or our deep sense of shared humanity that brings us here together. Rather, we need this deeper, multidimensional apprehension of the war and the system to arm ourselves, if you'll forgive a military metaphor, to confront it effectively, not only in its moral dimension, but its material and symbolic dimensions, which come together as a political phenomenon. That process of apprehending unfamiliar realities begins by calling all the dominant narratives into question. One of my most formative experiences politically while I was still in the Army was one of the many occasions when I went down to McKay's used bookstore in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where I would stock up on reading material to kill the long hours spent during military deployments, waiting around aircraft hangars, flying for hours on end, and generally following the bureaucratic imperative to hurry up and wait. And I picked up a well-beaten copy of a book called Inventing Reality by this guy named Michael Parenti, who you all had the opportunity, some of you had the opportunity to hear from in the last couple days. In that book, he systematically pointed out how various alleged connections along with sly discursive strategies are used by the capitalist media to build a version of the truth and relentlessly repeat it until it has the force of an article of religious faith. Nowadays, most progressives are very familiar with the craven pandering and the ideological huckstering of the corporate press. At the deepest level of trickery built into the way we know, however, more embedded in our thought processes even than what we get from the media is how part of the basis for what we see every day is systematically obscured. When we look at the things we buy, we do not see the labor memory of these things or the relations of domination and submission that created them. Economics has rendered that invisible. When we look at our money, serving as a universal solvent for the economy, we do not see how this solvent eats through the bonds of community and ravages those parts of the world that are invisible from our workplaces and living rooms. When we observe the so-called progress of our service and consumer economy, we who are comfortable do not see the devastation of abandoned inner cities. Geography and notions of black and brown deviance have rendered these invisible. We do not see the material basis of our affluence, who is a 16-year-old girl in Indonesia who labors 5 hours at a stretch without a bathroom break and is subject to the unwanted advances of a supervisor who knows that she lives on the margin of survival. We do not see as we go about our daily lives that each one of us as Americans can be measured against the rest of the world by how the average person globally uses 5.6 acres of land to support her existence while you and I use 24 apiece, and the average African uses less than one. We do not see how white supremacy lurks just below the paternalistic surface of our concern for the Iraqis by calling into question their ability and desire to make their own history. The system reproduces itself in the recursive relations between the economic exploitation, the petroleum and other natural resources that form the material and thermodynamic basis of the system, and the cultural, the racial ideology, consumerism, commodification of personality, and patriarchal constructions of sexuality. Each of these phenomena interfused and equally necessary for the continued reproduction of the whole system. It is an interarticulated, multidimensional system, and we have to confront it in nonlinear and dynamic new ways. For this, we need insurgent categories so we can learn new ways of knowing, so we can see what has been rendered invisible. Alf Hornberg said that a thorough analysis must struggle to distance itself from the cultural categories through which the system operates. He doesn't say that the categories we have are useless, but that they are incomplete. Dominant ideologies sometimes resort to misdirection or even lies and fables, but most often they retain their hegemony by rendering portions of reality invisible. So with all that as a preface, let me suggest, what are some of the invisible realities behind this war? The first thing I want to do is rename this war. It is not Gulf War II or the Iraq War or even the preposterous war on terrorism, as if you can declare war on a tactic. I want to call it Phase 2 of the World Energy War. The Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii has collected ice cores that demonstrate a 30% increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide since 1860. This is just one indicator of the extent to which we have transformed the very material basis of our existence, our biosphere, with the introduction of fossil fuels. It's also a warning bell about where we are headed when atmospheric warming associated with these carbon emissions, the rise of a few inches in sea levels, would effectively inundate hundreds of millions of people around the world, salinize estuaries and destroy soil fertility, shift tropical disease vectors and pathogens further into temperate zones, and create unstable weather patterns that generate more catastrophic weather events in heavily populated areas. Actually, all that's already happening. But fossil fuel exploitation has more consequences than the unintended ones. Combined with growth economics, fossil energy exploitation has given human societies the capacity to transform the material environment for economic purposes in unprecedented ways since around 1860, particularly in agriculture. The transformation of all nature, now even including its scenic vistas, into marketable commodities is the dominant determinative force in growth economies. The additional capacity added to that general tendency by fossil fuel is difficult to overestimate, and its impact tends to increase geometrically over time. Food, being necessary for individual human metabolism, is a special concern and has a special place in global social patterns of energy use. Using plain input-output models for food production, by 1994, Mario Giampietro and David Pimentel showed that one calorie of food requires approximately 10 calories of extrasomatic or fossil energy to produce. But that's a global average. In the industrialized metropoles of Europe, the United States, and Japan, that averages 40 calories of fossil fuel for every one calorie of food. And in the United States, the ratio is 90 to 1. Yet because of the global system of U.S. dollar seigniorage, which allows the U.S. to print money to cover its enlarging debt to other nations, which for reasons we can talk about later if we have time, and I appreciate that I have the most intrepid people left behind here at 9:30 at night, the U.S. never intends to pay this debt back. So it's effectively a subsidy to the whole United States from the rest of the world. The U.S., and because of that subsidy, the U.S. percentage of disposable income spent on food is actually remarkably low. It's around 15% of our budget. So if we set aside the monetary cost of food and focus solely on the energetic cost, and if we factor in variables like sun energy and disparate gross production figures, U.S. consumers, on average, are consuming five times the global average at below market value because of an external hidden subsidy provided by those throughout the world who are consuming less energy to eat. The same profligate energy waste that underwrites agriculture for the well-to-do nations and underwrites associated and equally destructive satellite activities to industrial growth-based food production, this is monoculture crop production. Monoculture crop production doesn't just require the fossil fuel for transportation and whatnot. It also requires petrochemical inputs for fertilizer and virtually every other activity that's involved in this form of crop production. The same system of dollar hegemony I just described not only forces foreign central banks to provide free loans to the U.S. government, it creates a situation where all nations need to have large supplies of U.S. dollars to pay their external debts, mostly via the United States-controlled International Monetary Fund. To get those dollars, they need to export to the United States and therefore to convert their entire economy to monoculture crop production. So in effect, as a Wall Street investment banker, investment broker named Henry C. K. Liu describes it, the U.S. makes dollars and the rest of the world makes things to get dollars. This imperative to export has transformed even the most underdeveloped nations into net food exporters compelled by market imperatives to produce food on a monocultural industrial model. That model is characterized by four major structural changes: the use of large tracts of land instead of small plots, the use of fossil fueled mechanization to fertilize, harvest, process, and transport the products, the need for massive irrigation efforts, which is responsible for the depletion of things like the Ogallala Aquifer, and the uprooting of most rural people and their transfer into the cities. They're not transferred into the cities because they're going there to find jobs that are already there. There are no jobs. They're in the cities because they've been decanted into the cities off the land. The few who remain behind in rural areas are now working for industrialized agriculture for wages, which is another shift from the former system where they worked for a share of the product. Not only does this increase the ecological and energy footprint of those newly urbanized populations, because urban living is more energy intensive than rural life, in a global economy that has suffered a net contraction since the 1970s, it has added a much larger aggregate unemployed population to the world, urban population. Now, unemployed in the urban wage sector without access to subsistence agriculture to guarantee basic survival. So here's an example of a hidden connection between energy and social disorder, and it's something I refer to in the book that's about to come out, Full Spectrum Disorder, is social entropy. In other words, energy and order are drawn toward wealth and urban concentrations, and the corresponding waste and disorder are exported onto those with the least political power in the social and geographical peripheries. This is what the environmental justice movement's all about. As fossil fuel production begins its permanent decline, with oil beginning almost immediately, there will be a crisis in food production that will hit the newly urbanized, unemployed peripheries with a terrible impact, and the reaction will be a terrible social fury. The massive growth of a deracinated and unemployed urban dwelling population around the world has already ignited social unrest as well as an explosion of criminal enterprise. The militarization of police tactics and the policification of military tactics that are blurring the distinctions between policing and militarily occupying are a reaction to precisely this phenomenon. And the eventual and inevitable decline of the fossil fuel economy will not leave behind the potentiality for a return to a more sustainable existence closer to nature, but a wrecked and grotesquely toxified and simplified biosphere with a huge overpopulation that's completely overshot the carrying capacity of what's left behind. We are currently undergoing, just as an example, the most dramatic period of species extinction since the dinosaurs. This is the end result of a global economy that is driven by so-called growth and by the Cartesian fallacy that man, which is always gendered and capitalized, of course, is somehow destined to subdue nature. It's a chimera, and a dangerous one at that, for us to believe that the profit motives at the heart of this system can in any way lead us out of this system's dilemmas. In a very real sense, the current global growth economy is one where nations that have the economic and military power are able to pull low entropy energy inputs like fossil fuel into themselves, using the resources of weaker countries, and to export their high entropy disorder back to those countries. The world is finite, and energy is, in a sense, a zero-sum game with the clock running, and those in power know it. And I pulled a quote from something one of my friends down here, that one of my new friends actually wrote, and you'll hear from him tomorrow, Jack Trumpdoor. In late 1991, this is an example, Lawrence Summers, the chief economist for the World Bank, delivered a confidential memo to a World Bank colleague. He asked, "Just between you and me, shouldn't the World Bank be encouraging more migration of the dirty industries to the less developed countries?" pointing to the cheaper economic valuation of human life calculated by the lower wages of third world workers, he boldly proposed, "I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that." It's physically impossible to develop the whole world in a manner similar to Europe and America and Japan. The resources simply do not exist to do that. Moreover, the advanced societies are not sustainable in their present form for more than two decades. Bringing the whole world to the same level of consumption of food, just as one example, at its energetic value, not monetary, would require an increase of energy inputs 8 times the current global average. If 6 billion people use petroleum at the Euro-American-Japanese per capita rate, it would require production of 120 billion barrels a year. Right now, production, which has peaked worldwide, is around 25 billion barrels, and it will now permanently decline. Not only would the oil, coal, and natural gas run out in fairly short order, so would copper, iron, zinc, manganese, phosphate, everything else. There simply is not, it would require 700 times the steel that currently exists in the world, and the iron ore is not there to do it, to develop the rest of the world like the industrialized metropoles. And a simple extrapolation of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions tells us another terrifying story if we attempt this kind of development, with right now the U.S. creating 25% of the carbon emissions and we only have 5% of the population. Now, the United States-dominated International Monetary Fund's savage structural adjustment programs that are a terminally parasitic form of loan sharking from which the victim is never intended to recover were shaped with the knowledge of this energy crisis. Look, capitalists have known about this for a long time. You know, people say capitalists don't study the left's political economy. That's not true. They know it better than we do. And they're doing this for the explicit purpose of guaranteeing that the periphery never develops and never grows strong enough to contest U.S. military power either. That's why we can refer to this stage of U.S. imperialism as an extermination phase. Look at the die-offs in progress right now in Africa and Russia, and you can see the intended results of the U.S.-controlled international relations. Look at the energy flows from the Gulf states to Europe and East Asia, especially China, whose petroleum thirst is rapidly approaching parity with that of the United States. These competitors are the secondary targets of the world energy war. In fact, if it weren't for the growth in the U.S. arms industry, there would be very little economic expansion through production at all in this country. Actual manufacturing for this country now takes place largely offshore. The U.S. role evolved during the Cold War as the military guarantor of the so-called free world, even though both Korea and Vietnam call the invincibility of the military into serious question, just as the Iraqi resistance is doing right now. The basis of U.S. power internationally is not their productivity. Productivity figures used by economists are illusory and measure output at the retail level at the same way that they would measure factory output. So it's another little bit of statistical legerdemain. U.S. productivity figures are false. U.S. power is based on dollar hegemony, and the debt leverage that flows from that, and a network of military installations around the world that puts the U.S. in control of all the world's primary sea lanes. In this moment of phase two of the world energy war, as the U.S. is facing a potential deflationary crisis and latent rebellions around the globe, the military has become the key institution for the preservation of that power. So it behooves us to pay close attention to that institution and to observe it for weaknesses that we as a movement can exploit. I want to argue that we have immense potential power in this regard. Right now, the United States Armed Forces are caught between the rock of their centrality to the Bush Doctrine and the hard place of their overextension in Southwest Asia. This is an institutional dilemma that overlaps the social dilemma created by the fact that the active duty armed forces, particularly the ground force components of the Army and Marine Corps, are populated largely by working class youth and insignificant fractions by youth from oppressed nationalities, both African American and Hispano Latina. Reserve and National Guard, however, tend to be older and more economically established in the civilian sectors. More about that later. Many active duty troops entered military service as an economic choice, as my own son did. He had an infant. He didn't have health care for him. He was working at McDonald's. He grew up in a military community. He went to what he knew. And he's in Ramadi, Iraq right now. I hope to get him back in one piece in March. Many active duty troops entered military service as an economic choice, not fully appreciating the situation developing under the direction of the Bush administration, and many were influenced by the slick Madison Avenue recruitment appeals that promised both adventure and status. Reservists and National Guards are largely motivated, however, by a desire for supplemental income. Now, the Bush administration's political doctrine of making the decisive break with post-World War II multilateral imperialism and the Rumsfeld military doctrine that has attempted to substitute technological systems for intuitive leadership and troop numbers, combined with the self-delusion of this administration about Iraq, has created a kind of perfect storm that now threatens the pivotal institution of the military itself with plummeting morale and a recruitment and retention crisis that will damage that institution for years, with a junior leadership void that will reduce the aggregate experience and maturity of the very strata of leadership that carries out all the day-to-day activities that makes the military as an institution run. In a real sense, the continued ability of the United States government to call the tune for the rest of the world now depends largely on military force and the threat of military force, even as that capacity to both operate and intimidate is diminished by the very real quagmire that's developed in Iraq. The inexorable direction in which this political morass is developing has made it politically impossible to leave Iraq, even as it appears that it is probably militarily impossible to win there. We need to remind ourselves that the success of military operations is not ultimately measured in tactical outcomes, but in political outcomes. So what does all this mean for the movement to end the war and the movement inside the anti-war movement that is explicitly anti-imperialist? I think it means at least three things, and all three of these things are connected. First, it means that the movement has to make an effort to defamiliarize itself with two-dimensional stereotypes about military people and begin to think of them as an organizable population, just as we do laborers or women or oppressed nationalities. Right now, the Bring Them Home Now campaign of Veterans for Peace and Military Families Speak Out is connecting to military communities largely through primary contacts with women who are the parents or spouses of troops. While the conditions are not conducive to open rebellion in the ranks, they are proving extremely conducive to nurturing a critical thinking process among these family members that they are beginning to effectively share with their uniformed loved ones. The old organizer standbys of relationship building, active listening, and non-judgmental empathy are essential first steps for mobilizing the huge political potential of veterans, military families, and even troops. All of you can see the public face of this campaign if you go to our website at www.bringthemhomenow.org. Good website. We've got a really good webmaster working on it. When I first started talking a few minutes ago, I made a point of describing both war and politics as phenomena with both a material and symbolic or ideological dimension. The strength of this campaign has been how it has grasped both those dimensions. First, material, by targeting the actual people in the military, and second, symbolically, by delegitimating the National Command Authority with regard to both its integrity and its competence. The National Command Authority is the President, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor. But mostly the President, the Secretary of Defense. The international movement as a whole, especially before the March Offensive, did the same thing on a larger scale, and it was mentioned earlier. They denied the United States military the north-to-south axis of advance out of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Many commentators, in their infatuation with the notion of a Sunni triangle, have missed the fact that much of the Iraqi military and its materiel melted into this region not out of ethnic affinity, but out of geographical necessity in the face of the U.S. southern offensive. The movement had a material effect on the battlefield by delegitimating the war in places like Turkey and thereby denying the U.S. as a northern front. That material effect is still in force right now. The strength at this early stage of the Iraqi resistance right now is a direct result, in many respects, of the international movement against the war. So whether that makes you comfortable or not doesn't change the fact that it's a reality. People say we didn't have an effect because we didn't stop the war. We had an effect. We're still having an effect. And I'm, in particular, a little twisted up around that, having a loved one who's in theater. The second task of this movement is domestic. And this is a good segue because it's to delegitimate the U.S. government at home. The various campaigns to educate the public about the incredibly transparent willingness of this administration to lie, cheat, and intimidate are important to keep those currently in office on the defensive and blunt their capacity to carry out their agenda. And I understand what everyone said about Democrats, and, you know, I know all that, but the fact of the matter is the broader movement against this particular administration right now is keeping them off balance. And it's keeping them off balance in a way where they cannot re-seize the initiative and pursue this mad agenda they're on. The upcoming elections can amplify not just the anodyne assaults of the Democratic candidates, but the issues of corporate malfeasance, the fascist roundup of immigrants, the outrage of Guantanamo Bay, the Patriot Act, the phony pretext for this war. All of it, thanks. An administration, I wasn't meant it as an applause line, but I don't know if any of them are. an administration on the defensive is rendered incapable and right now they're vulnerable if we're willing to do the work to make them vulnerable. The final suggestion I have will take advantage of the institutional crisis in the military itself. And this relates to what we were hearing about, sort of the intra-class rivalry that's going on right now that comes out as all these bureaucratic catfights. there's a severe recruitment shortage in the reserves and National Guards as extension after extension strains families and disrupts careers. Few reserves or active duty troops deployed in Iraq are signing up for a second hitch, even with the new sweetener of a $10,000 reenlistment bonus. My own son, now in Iraq, who was considering a military career, has now thankfully decided that he will get out after his first hitch. Oh, thank you, there is a God. The military has been forced to implement a kind of covert draft through the stop-loss program, where troops are now being involuntarily extended beyond their original discharge dates. After the 2004 elections, we have good reason to worry about an overt draft, but not now. So there's a way to multiply this crisis, and that is through counter-recruitment. Counter-recruitment campaigns are things that we can do, each of us, in our own communities, because, you know, there's a recruiting station everywhere. We need anti-war veterans to begin speaking with high school students. We need public education through community organizations and churches and synagogues and mosques. We need people to gather correct information about recruitment. Don't go down there and lie like they do. Make sure you do your homework and go to the recruiting offices. They're in your community, and have the conversations with the same young folks who are talking to recruiters. And we need to keep denying these numbers. Even they don't recruit more than one or two people a day. If you deny them one, you're having an impact. If someone's denying them one in every recruiting office across the country, we're having a huge impact. And we want to keep doing this until the military gets the order to withdraw American occupation forces from Southwest Asia. Thank you for hanging with me. This retention and recruitment crisis is also creating profound consternation at the Pentagon, where the generals, as was mentioned earlier, who have committed their lives to the armed forces see the clueless and arrogant Donald Rumsfeld laying waste to them from the inside, as George W. Bush's neocon handlers commit them beyond their external capacity in the world energy war. It is not insignificant that the War College just 2 days ago published a scathing attack on the Iraqi operation, or that the International Monetary Fund has been publicly critical of the increasingly precarious U.S. current accounts deficit. Speculators like Warren Buffett and George Soros are selling dollars, and Soros has become the single most significant funder of nonprofit issue advocacy that strengthens the Democratic Party. These are indicators of both confusion and restlessness in the citadels of power. And it is in this interstice that we have the potential to advance not just the anti-war movement, but to inject new language, new symbols, and new categories into public discourse. Within the movement, we have to be relentless and patient. We have to work harder, even as we understand that we might not see all the consequences of our work or the cumulative effect, which will take time. We cannot be an instant gratification movement because history does not operate at an instant gratification tempo. And we cannot confuse setbacks with defeat, or we will lose sight of the fact that defeat is not defined by our position, but by our acceptance. People in the Philippines, people in the Philippines, in Colombia and Sri Lanka and Bolivia and South Africa and Venezuela, in Nigeria and Iraq and Turkey and Argentina and Brazil and Haiti, people all over the world are resisting and have been resisting U.S. imperialism through dangerous days and hungry nights and in the face of a choice not between one ideology or another, but between rebellion or extinction. That is the degree of their commitment and their clarity. And we must match that commitment and clarity word for word and deed for deed, because they need us and we need them. A little over a year ago, I became a grandfather. And now I find myself counting the days before I can see my baby, which is coming up this Friday, yes. every time I'm with that little boy, I'm reaffirmed in the rightness of this struggle. And that's when, in the face of all this conflict that certainly lies ahead, I can take a little joy from our solidarity. And I want to thank all of you for being here tonight and putting up with me this late. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to do a brief Q&A with Stan. It's going to be the same format. Raise your hand. We'll pick on you. You come up to the mic here. Again, we appreciate it if it doesn't turn into a speech. We can keep things moving. And
I'm not being critical, but next time we do one of these things, we need to get some Revolutionary Sisters up here, too.
I wanted to ask whether you have been doing the counter-recruitment?
Recruitment.
Yep. And if you have any suggestions about, like, numbers of people, it might be effective to see folks working in recruitment office in terms of your presence.
Thank you.
Did everybody hear that? Okay, it was, if I don't paraphrase you correctly, forgive me, I'm so toast right now. It was a question about how to go, if I'd done any kind of recruitment, and what are the right ways to sort of approach that task. I'm on the coordinating committee of the Bring Them Home Now campaign, and this is an initiative that we're just in the formative process right now, because it's just at this point where it's really become clear that this is such a tough problem inside the military. We're having a hard time getting accurate information from the Department of Defense, and I know that's a big surprise. when we read the story about the reporters going up and asking the troops in Iraq about the $10,000 bonus, and they laughed at them, that was a pretty good battlefield indicator of what the attitude was. And then it's talking, we're actually in communication with some of the GIs that are over there. but this is something that's just, like I say, it's in the very first formative stages. It's not something that requires a lot of process. You know, that's the beauty of it. It's decentralized. It gives, you know, people from the hood can go down. You see what I'm saying? It's the people that you know. It's in your own neighborhoods where these recruitment offices are. And you can go, I think the GI Rights Hotline right now and the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force both have information about to take with you for counter recruitment. So just go find the right information. We will have some information on our website, but it's probably going to take a month or so before we get it up there. Check in on our website. We have news updates every day. We have a sound off section in there where GIs can write in anonymously. Veterans are writing in, military families are writing in, and sounding off. And there's also some suggestions in there for getting involved in the community. But no, the short answer to your question is we haven't really kicked off in the counter recruitment, but we see it as a high strategic priority. And again, don't overthink it. Just make sure you get the correct information and show up and talk to these kids. You know, because they're down there a lot of times. You know, they've been watching an Army of One, you know, and all this other just, you know, forgive me, but utter bullshit that they get from the media. And they hear about, you know, we're going to get money for college, you know, which you do. You get money for college, which is great, provided, you know, that you're not in a psych ward or an amputee ward or something like that whenever you have to go. So, you know, they just need a reality check when they go down there. And sometimes that'll make the difference. Yeah.
Thank you. Who's next?
Oh, he asked me why did I join the Army, and how did I end up here? Boy, oh boy, I'm writing my third book, and I still hadn't figured it out yet. I don't know. It was a long time ago. It was 34 years ago when I joined. I was a boy, you know, and you'd be surprised, you know, how much we damage boys whenever we raise them. You know, with the G.I. Joes and Disney and all that stuff. So, you know, I was doing a boy thing, and I believed in what Bill Blum was talking about earlier. I believed that I had to go out and do something about this international communist conspiracy, because if we didn't stop them in Vietnam, they'd be in Hot Springs, Arkansas in short order. And it sounded exciting, and I think I wanted to impress a girl. It's one of those things that's sort of, it's an overdetermined decision. So I don't know why I went in. But once you get in, I got out. I took a short break in service. I ended up in Monticello, Arkansas, working in a sweatshop. And it was real easy for me to go back in because I didn't like the sweatshop. And at least I got to work outdoors when I was in the Army. A piecework sweatshop, which is the worst kind of sweatshop. Sewing inseams. and then the Army proceeded to give me the best radical education in the world by sending me to 8 conflict areas and letting me spend a lot of time in developing countries doing total cultural immersion and spending time with people that didn't look like me or speak my language and making me smarter than I was before I got there. And there's a lot more people like that. I got my Veterans for Peace T-shirt on underneath this. And if you look around, there's 2 or 3 other people that were walking around in it. This notion of the military as like robots is just such nonsense. You know, the military people think at least as critically as the average American does in this, you know, consumerized, atomized, alienated society. And in some cases, they think even more clearly, and they ask a lot of questions. And I don't think that they deserve any special moral censure. People that work in Walmart are every bit as much of this system as people who work in the military. If you just back up and, you know, These are economic choices. These are economic choices. You know, I wouldn't go back in the military, but I sure as hell not going to go to work for Walmart either, if I can help it. And I'm not sure if I got off topic there. But again, you know, there were things. Parenti's book, Inventing Reality, was one of those things that sort of broke up a logjam for me a little bit. It's like, oh, okay, well, then I don't have to believe any of this stuff. But then if I don't believe any of this stuff, what do I believe? And I started looking at things more directly. And the other thing that in particular was helpful for me was in the 80s, I don't know, I worked directly out of the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala in 1983. I was there for the last coup d'etat when Rios Montt was thrown out by Mejia Victorious. In 1985, I was in El Salvador working out of the embassy when Inez Guadalupe Duarte was kidnapped, and also right there about a week after the attack at Zona Rosa. So I got a peek at the system. It was sort of a privilege peek because most military people don't get to work in the embassy. Got to see the country team. Everybody should look at a U.S. embassy and how it's organized, and it's quite an education. You got a consular section that does passports and visas and all that stuff, you know, and facilitates travel to and from, and you've got a security section that does security clearances and runs the ambassador's bodyguard detail, and then you've got the MIL group, that's the military liaison with the host nation, and you've got the Econ group, which is the liaison with the country's National Chamber of Commerce. No kidding, Chamber of Commerce. No, that's standard. That's the way it works. You know, and then you've got the chief, you got the ambassador and his or her deputy. And you got the political section, which is a euphemism for the Central Intelligence Agency. And when you watch the country team meetings, the agenda is set by the econ section, set by the economic section. That's who sets the agenda at the meetings. It's like, oh, I mean, you know, I'm slow. It's like, oh, okay, I get it. It's the money, you know, because I really didn't want to believe that that's what the deal was. I didn't want to believe that that's why, you know, people were coming into the embassy bragging about the fact that they'd murdered Mayan school teachers, you know. So that shifted me a little bit. and then my last deployment to Haiti was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. But, you know, you learn. And it's not just me. I'm not like, unique. It's out there. I just scribble a lot more than most people. Yeah. Yes, sir.
This gentleman right here.
My question concerns bringing the troops home now, part of the equation.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville.
Kind of
paraphrasing. Yeah, it was a question about, there's a, and this is a big open question, and you know, what was formerly the Unified Anti-War Movement before the actual the March Offensive took place, whether or not American troops, now that they're there, should stay there to ensure a degree of stability so that the place doesn't break down into utter chaos and civil war. My own feeling, well, first of all, there's sort of two different... This administration has no intention of pulling out. They politically, they're stuck there. So we're not going to get a decision from the Bush administration to withdraw from Iraq. Partly because there's not enough domestic discontent right now, you know, and they've got all their backup things like Diabol voting systems and all this other stuff. But so that's not what's going to happen. The call to bring them home now is a demand, and I think it's a legitimate demand. I don't think, regardless of what, you know, one person's anecdotal experience was with, you know,
people who may or may not have been telling them what they wanted to hear. I don't think that the vandal that comes in and tears up my home is the right one for me to contract with to build it back up or to guard it from the next set of vandals.